Welcome. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our panel discussion today. Our discussion is co-hosted by the Hellenic Observatory at the London School of Economics and the Anglo-Hellenic League. As director of the observatory, it's my great pleasure to welcome the chair of the Anglo-Hellenic League, John Kitmer. The observatory and the league share many common interests. The League is dedicated to promoting Anglo-Greek understanding and friendship, and the League has a very long history of charitable and cultural work. You can visit the Anglo-Hellenic League's website to find more information about its events, its activities, and indeed to consider joining the Anglo-Hellenic League. My role this evening is to welcome you and to introduce our speakers. John Kitmer will follow later and chair the discussion with our speakers. Let me say, John is a man of many talents. He's a former UK ambassador to Greece. He has a PhD in modern Greek literature, and he's currently preparing books about Gavafi and Yanis Ritsos. That sounds a pretty good start. Depending on your point of view, both in Britain and in Greece, we've been experiencing the politics of populism. In any event, a new kind of discourse has entered our political life. Old assumptions, standards, and styles are said to be under threat. The levels of public trust in our politicians have declined. Experts and expertise are more readily dismissed, and street protests seem more potent than before. Why? One dominant explanation has it that the role of the media and how we receive our news, our understanding of what is happening in the world, has changed. The traditional media is under threat with the digital revolution. The prevalence of new social media offers us alternative news accounts. The ultimate irony, perhaps, is that the World Wide Web has isolated us into our particular social cocoons as to who we listen to, who we talk to, who we interact with. Whether it's conspiracy theories about the COVID-19 vaccines or climate change or simply celebrity gossip, misinformation hits home. And in this context, we ask the question this evening, can the mainstream media win against alternative sources of information? What is the future for our mainstream media? Let me introduce our panel of speakers who can help us understand what's happening and what the risks might be. I'll introduce them in the order that they will be speaking to us. Tony Barber is European Comment Editor for the Financial Times. He's been the Financial Times' Europe Editor, and he's served in its bureaus in Frankfurt, Rome, and Brussels. Nikos Konstantaris is a columnist for the Kathimerini newspaper in Athens. Indeed, he's one of Greece's most respected journalists, known for his telling insights and potent opinions. David Patrikarakos, David Patrikarakos is journalist, author, and analyst. His 2017 book, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century, seems spot on for our discussion here this evening. And Eleni Vavitsiotti is the Greece and Cyprus correspondent for the Financial Times. Previously, she worked for Kathimerini and also for Sky TV in Greece. Before we start, those of you watching us on Twitter, can I invite you to send us your comments at any stage, and we suggest the hashtag for today is hashtag LSE Greece. Let me mention that the discussion is being recorded, and we hope to upload it onto the website, subject to there being no technical difficulties. We invite you, our audience, to put your questions. You can do so if you're watching on Zoom using the Q&A facility at the bottom of your screen. and we'll try to get through as many as possible. Please tell us of any affiliation you may have and where you're watching us from. That's always of great interest. And please, can you keep your questions short? We look forward to those questions, and you can send those questions at any time. So to begin, can I invite Tony Barber to make his opening comments, please? Over to you, Tony.
Thank you, Kevin. Hello, everyone. I'm going to take up three questions this evening. What is fake news? How serious a problem is it? And what can mainstream news organizations do about it, if anything? For the purposes of this event, I'll use the definition of fake news that comes from a British-based global law firm, Norton Rose Fulbright. And they call fake news, quote, the distribution online of false information disguised as legitimate news stories, unquote. Motives behind it may be political, financial, or personal, they say. Well, it's a useful definition, but we should keep in mind that fake news existed long before the internet. We just had different ways of describing it, such as lies, propaganda, and bullshit. And by the way, some of it was generated not by enemies of the mainstream media, but by parts of the media themselves, or indeed by anyone with a pen, paper, or printing machine to hand. But I want to tell you a short story that shows how, in the pre-internet age, even a respectable news organization could be caught up in distributing fake news. In 1985, I was a reporter for Reuters news agency in Moscow, and I came across an article in a Soviet publication, Literaturnaya Gazeta, which alleged that the HIV/AIDS condition had originated in American military experiments. And this article claimed to be based on the investigations of an Indian newspaper. Now, I knew the Soviet article was propaganda, and I was inclined not to write anything about it. But I discussed it with my bureau chief in Moscow, and we decided that we should do a story reporting the Soviet allegations, but making it as clear as we could that there was no objective evidence to support them. The problem was that the Reuters article we wrote appeared in newspapers all over the world, Africa, Asia, South America, Western countries. And so the Soviet lies got wide attention and continued to spread for some years after 1985. And then, after the Soviet Union's collapse, the last head of the KGB revealed that the article in Literaturnaya Gazeta had been planted by the KGB. Now, the point of this story is that fake news has been around for a very long time. No doubt it stands out more today because of the sheer speed with which it can circulate on social media compared with, say, 1985. Today, once it's out there, it's very hard to rebut or discredit or kill completely. But it always has been. In English history, just think of the so-called Popish Plot of 1678, a completely fictitious Catholic conspiracy to overthrow Protestantism and the monarchy, and the torrents of anti-Catholic propaganda that backed up this fake news overwhelmed the government of the day. Truth, reason, evidence succumbed to lies and hysteria. So the answer to my second question, how serious a problem is fake news, is that it's always been serious. Yes, the fact that fake news can be distributed to millions of people at the click of a mouse makes it more challenging to combat. And yes, the emergence of synthetic media or deep fakes or false information and data generated by algorithms means that we live in a world where deception uses more sophisticated techniques. But the fundamental problem isn't much different from what past generations dealt with. It's about lies versus truth, and it always has been. And so to my third question, what to do about it? It's too convenient for the mainstream media, and for that matter, politicians and regulators, to cast the big tech companies as the villains in all this. Sure, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and others have not done a satisfactory job of keeping their houses in order, despite the launch in recent years of various tools to help users identify fake news. Now, you can impose stricter regulation on the tech giants. You can punish them when they fall short. You can insist that they clamp down on anonymous spreaders of disinformation, on fake news sites, and so on. But I don't think any of this will stamp out the problem, because it won't address the underlying conditions that have made fake news a permanent feature of human society for centuries. And even stricter regulation in the UK alone might not have much of an effect. Presumably, we don't want a national internet firewall in a free society. It seems to me that fake news will always be accessible to people in the UK who want to get it from somewhere. And this is part of my point. There is a demand for lies, a demand for half-truths and exaggerations, as well as a supply. And in this respect, much of the public is no more innocent than some politicians and some celebrities and some mainstream media that have made a tidy living out of propaganda distortions and alarming or alluring nonsense for a long time. From the fake Zinoviev letter published in the Daily Mail in 1924 to Freddie Starr Ate My Hamster, the Sun's headline of 1986, the British tradition of bollocks masquerading as news is long and rich. Furthermore, we in the UK and other democracies live in an age of political partisanship, social cleavages, and widespread mistrust of many forms of authority. And this renders people who might prefer the truth susceptible to conspiracy theories and disinformation. And for this situation, some mainstream media have only themselves to blame. But it hardly helps matters when, as in the UK's 2019 general election, political parties themselves presented campaign material in the form of fake newspaper front pages. So are there any answers? Well, you can train people better from school onwards to spot fake news on social media. You can tell them to look with a more critical eye at what purport to be legitimate news sites. And steps like this will probably help a bit. But in the end, I fear we are faced with the uncomfortable truth that lies are part of life. And of course, we should work hard every day to expose these lies and fight them. But we shouldn't be under any illusions. This is not a battle that can end with complete victory. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Set is often a very fatalistic platform. Nico.
Good evening, everybody, and many thanks from my part as well for being invited to this wonderful event tonight. I'd like to ask you to please keep Tony's very pertinent comments in mind while I describe the situation in Greece over the past few years, because I think he provided a very good framework for the subject. I will go into what's happened in Greece in the last couple of years. With the COVID pandemic hit most countries and professions with a blinding light, showing weaknesses, failures, and perhaps, if we are lucky, even possible solutions to the problems that we can see. Greek society and its news media, both the so-called legacy media and the social media, are no exception. The great disruption of the pandemic came like a great wave after 10 years of economic crisis, exacerbating the feelings of insecurity and hopelessness which people had been feeling already. And these in turn encouraged a torrent of conspiracy theories of misinformation and disinformation. It's worth remembering that objectively, the pandemic could have been the final economic blow to Greece's news media. Advertising disappeared overnight, dropping by 90% in some sectors. Whatever little there was could not go far in a fragmented landscape in which close to 1,000 electronic news sites are registered with the press ministry. If it were not for two public awareness campaigns financed by the government, one worth 20 million euros and the other 11 million, many newspapers, portals, websites, radio and television stations, and so on would have been forced to close. These campaigns, which were aimed at making people aware of the dangers of the pandemic, were most useful to the news media, but the government made a major mistake in the way that it distributed the funds. Some of it went to websites that did not seem to have any traffic and that did not warrant such support, while some media which were critical of the government did not receive anything or very little. Whatever the reasoning behind the way the funds were distributed, this mistake has been most costly for society and the news media as a whole. It has fed into the divisions that have always existed, and this is our problem, because disinformation today is just the continuation of the lack of trust that we have in our public life and in our news media chronically. News media have always been highly partisan in Greece, following closely the great divisions of the past 100 or so years in politics and society. Long before social media, long before Donald Trump and other big man types steamrolled our sensitivities at a global level with their indifference to the truth, in Greece, we were already locked into a pattern where we are indifferent to the lies that our side tells and highly tuned to anything suspicious from the other side. When social media, Facebook, Twitter, and others erupted onto the scene, they found countless foot soldiers ready to hit their keyboards and touch screens as if launching nuclear missiles at every provocation, trivial or not. So in the early stages of the pandemic, when Greek society showed admirable self-discipline and helped make the government's handling of the first wave a case study of a crisis well handled, the misstep in the handout to news media did not make a great impression. As time passes, though, it has contributed towards further undermining the credibility of the mainstream news media, which for the most part has been maintaining a serious position on the pandemic. Opposition parties and the media allied with them can keep claiming that the mainstream media are unreliable because they're in the government's pocket. This investment in public insecurity contributed towards the blooming of disinformation with regard to vaccinations, leading in turn to a government decision to change the penal code to make it clear that anyone found guilty of disseminating false news that is capable, as it says, false news that is capable of causing concern or fear to the public or undermining public confidence in the national economy, the country's defense capacity or public health, would be liable to a jail term of at least 3 months and a fine. This has understandably prompted outrage from journalists' unions, jurists, and opposition parties with accusations that the government is curbing media freedom. So we're in this turmoil where one step leads to another step, leading to greater lack of confidence. And this makes it even more difficult for people to have faith in news media, as anyone trying to be objective in this climate is seen by a large number of others as serving the interests of one or other side. The phenomenon of disinformation is directly dependent on the lack of trust in news media. The long tradition of division which breeds suspicion and cynicism has created a warped kind of media literacy. People are very quick to see problems in the other side's arguments and to forgive their own trespasses. This is because they have always known that what matters is who owns the news media and what their aims are. A recent academic study of 10 European nations found that the Greeks had the highest sense of misinformation and disinformation in their society, and were the only ones among the 10 to perceive more disinformation than misinformation. We suspect that we are told lies on purpose, not by mistake. Newspaper sales have been declining rapidly for years. Today, they're about a tenth of what they were at the turn of the century. People know that newspaper owners are often close to politicians and other business interests, contributing to advocacy journalism either on behalf of certain owners and political parties or against them. State media are tightly controlled despite the best efforts of individual journalists involved. With the economic crisis and the dominance of digital media, Lack of funds means the owners need to commercialize their assets even further. And in this climate, journalism is not a wise career choice. The starting salary is 650 euros a month gross, or 550 euros take home. These young journalists, often working at understaffed news sites, are pushed to the limit, leading to mistakes. And any mistake is magnified by the immediate clamor on social media, leading to another cycle. One thing that the pandemic has shown, with the proliferation of fake news that has contributed to a lower than expected vaccination rate, is that despite the plentiful, good, reliable, responsible information in many news media, the truth is irrelevant to those who choose not to accept it. Greater responsibility by media owners and journalists, a conscious effort by politicians and institutions to encourage a pluralistic and independent press will certainly help improve Greek society. But the problem is much deeper. We need to deal with a template of polarization that warps everything that comes close to it. And it'll take a lot more than fact-checking and other such new tools that exist. And as we said, the media literacy exists, but it's warped. What we need is the socioeconomic shifts that are in the question of tonight's discussion, and which we could discuss further.
Thank you, Nico, very much. Some very concerning points. David.
Hi, so I'm not going to give a presentation so much as discuss a couple of the things that I observed, particularly in the Greek language space over the past few years, and building on the excellent contributions of my two previous panelists. So I want to talk about COVID, you know, the pandemic, which was touched upon by Nikos. Now, what we saw during the pandemic, I watch some of these spaces. I look at disinformation, I look at misinformation. Now, I'm sure we all know, but just to give a brief definition, you know, misinformation is the unintentional spreading of falsehoods. You know, disinformation is the intentional spreading of falsehoods, usually to achieve a particular goal, financial, whatever. Now, what COVID-19 did, it was brought us a health pandemic. It also brought us something else. It brought us an infodemic, what we call an infodemic. This was an explosion of information brought about by the pandemic, by which I mean everybody went online, everybody was talking about it. And what you saw was huge amounts of disinformation and misinformation. Again, misinformation, the unintentional spreading of falsehoods, because people were scared. They didn't know what this was. If you remember as well, government messaging in the very early stages of the pandemic was extremely poor. You have to wear masks. No, you don't need to wear masks. Don't wear masks because you're going to, you know, the hospitals won't have any. So we had this explosion of misinformation, scared people going online, speculating. What can we do? This cures COVID. This doesn't, you know, herd immunity, no herd immunity. And what we saw is we saw disinformation actors take advantage of this. I wrote a column there and I said, you know, look, when the world is more polluted, your emissions are easier to go through unnoticed. So we saw, particularly from certain states, you know, a variety of narratives being pushed. And particularly in the Greek language space, where there exists already a certain indulgence of conspiracy theory. So in this infodemic, what really struck me was the degree to which there are vulnerabilities in our public sphere. Now, our public sphere used to be this accretion of newspapers and magazines and radio and TV. And to a large extent, it still is. But, you know, we have to accept now that our public sphere is very much curated in Silicon Valley now. You know, these huge platforms that we'll get on that are sort of ripe for abuse. Because I find it very interesting about the way we look at information now. Now, let's take a look at, you know, let's say Twitter. You know, it's not the biggest platform, but it's where a lot of us journalists, us opinion formers are on. What is the definition of a good tweet? Now, if I write a tweet saying, the best thing to do with COVID-19 is to socially distance, wear a mask, and, you know, be careful. And it gets 10 tweets. If someone writes a tweet saying, don't get the vaccine because Bill Gates will have access to your brain, and it gets 100 tweets, that's a better tweet. Just is, right? Because the metrics we use have become slightly different. We are talking about social media platforms that are constitutionally geared toward virality. That is why, you know, Donald Trump was such an effective user of Twitter. I really, really struck home the degree to which, you know, we saw the promulgation of fake news, or, you know, following on from Tony, as I like to call it, lying throughout the pandemic. And, you know, you really saw certain states push narratives. And what was really interesting for me about the pandemic was, you know, coronavirus is fundamentally invisible. So you can map onto it anything you want. And we saw it basically take the place of whatever, you know, whatever party, politician, state wanted. So in one sense, coronavirus was a way for certain narratives we saw coming out of, say, Russia to say that, you know, the Western medical services were collapsing. They're in turmoil. You know, hospitals couldn't cope. They were, for other narratives coming out of perhaps accounts associated to Beijing, an example of how autocracy is far superior to democracy because, you know, the Chinese could shut everything down. I saw far-right accounts going, well, this clearly shows now that we have to shut our borders because, you know, we can't have this coming through. You know, the age-old trope of, you know, foreigners bringing contagion. And then on the hard-left accounts, I saw, well, this just proves that we need, if not communism, state control of economics. This was an absolute disinformation free-for-all. I want everybody to understand this. There were two pandemics here, a health one and an informational one. And I want to be actually clear because the informational one has serious health effects. If you are telling people not to get the vaccine, this is a serious public health threat, especially if you are allied to, let's say, certain states that have their own vaccines that they want to push. So they undermine AstraZeneca. We saw this. We saw this in Greece. I saw this in Greece. I saw this in Cyprus, in the Greek language space. Consistent undermining, for example, of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine in favor of the Sputnik vaccine. What we have seen is that certain elements in society now have become, you know, greater disinformation spreaders than others. We see certain elements of orthodoxy, especially those closely aligned with Russia, that, you know, were spreading a lot of COVID disinformation. We saw, you know, certain elements coming out of the North Macedonia Greek thing. You know, Greece and the Greek language space, I want to be very clear on this now, has become an intense informational battleground. People don't realize this. It's become a bit like, not quite as bad, but like Ukraine, it's become a front line of an informational war that is sort of kind of ongoing with certain states. Greece is a very important state now. We saw this with the Prespa agreement. We saw the huge informational attack. And, you know, it's still here. You know, Greece is key to the Balkans. You know, the vision of Thessaloniki, Balkan integration, Greece is integral to that. And, you know, I watch the spaces again and we see a lot of uptick here. We see a lot of disinformation going in against Balkan integration and a lot of it attacking Greece for its supposed role in that. There's something else I would like to address here. This is something that I kind of work on with policymakers and stuff. Now, Tony, again, was absolutely spot on. What are you going to do about lying? Like, what are you going to do? Like, the fact is, it is not illegal to lie, and nor should it be, right? Without lying, there is no society. You know, I love your mother. Your baby's absolutely gorgeous. We need to lie. That's not the issue. So what do you do when you have, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, a lot of people are assholes. You can't legislate for that. So what do you do? So we've thought about this. I've thought about it for a long time. And where I push policymakers, or I urge them to go, I don't push anybody, I urge them, is to think about it this way. Say, look, we cannot stop people from lying. So look for the behavior. So what does that mean? It means, look, if Billy Bob from Tennessee wants to say that Hillary Clinton punches badgers, he can say that. What are we going to do? But if it turns out that Billy Bob from Tennessee is in fact Ivan from St. Petersburg, that's where you act. If it turns out that this absolute outrage, you know, in northern Athens about migrants actually isn't a spontaneous outrage, it's actually a load of accounts in Moldova, that's where you have to act. So I think we need to reconceptualize how we deal with fake news, or more correctly, lying. You can't stop people lying. Let's look to the behavior. And again, we saw this. I saw this again, looking at the Greek spaces. People, unfortunately, are just going to spread conspiracy theories. I mean, if memory serves, and you know, you're all far greater Greek scholars than me, but I'm pretty sure that Thucydides moans about this, like, you know, thousands of years ago, about people just willing to believe any old nonsense rather than check it themselves. Clearly, this is a problem with humanity. Clearly, it's not going to go away. We're just going to have to deal with it. We can have public literacy campaigns, health campaigns, and so forth. But look to the behavior, because what I saw in the Greek language spaces was a lot of, yes, people just going online and saying, oh, my brother told me that if you eat an onion, you can't get COVID, whatever. But there was also a lot of what the platforms call coordinated inauthentic behavior. These were fake. These were absolutely, you know, fake accounts. These were bots in many cases. These were trolls. And the impact that they have is not all-encompassing, right? Let's not forget, a lot of this stuff is very crude. But these people play the percentages, right? You throw everything at the wall, and if 10% sticks, it's a win. And it is affecting our informational environment, and it is affecting public health, and it is affecting societal health. You know, vaccine refusal is always going to be there. It's the long tradition of it, but it is being nudged by what we are seeing online, especially in countries like Greece. So I think the pandemic, the infodemic that it brought, showed us very, very clearly the dangers that we are facing. And I think now we have to take a tougher line and to reconceptualize it. We're obsessed with content. We're obsessed with, well, this is fake news, lying. We have to take it down. You can't take it down. Some of it you can take down. Bear in mind, I say this with a caveat that we have laws, right? Hate speech, illegal. Incitement to violence, illegal. Now, the fact that I can go on any platform and find hate speech, racism, violence in 2 seconds is another issue. That's an enforcement issue from the platforms. Which brings me on to my final point. What do we do about it? When I give talks on this subject, I always ask a question. I say to people, how long were movies silent for? And the answer is 30 years. Before, and that's before they even had color. The point I make by that is these social media are still very new technologies. How long have they really been around? Okay, Facebook came in 2004, if you're in Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Yale. But loosely speaking, let's say just over 10 years, we are still in the early stages of this. People don't know how to do it. Is it a web, you know, is it a utility? Is it a private company? But the fact is this, look, I'm sorry, but Mark Zuckerberg's job is not to make sure the news you get is true. His job is to make money for his shareholders. That's it. I'm not saying because he's a horrible guy. I mean, he probably is a horrible guy, but that's it. That's just his job, right? It just is. It's not his job to make sure that COVID disinformation doesn't, that's not his job. His job is paid as a private company or a public company, but it's a company. This needs to come from government. Government's role in the end is legislative, and it needs to legislate. I remember the tech hearings. You know, they were kind of reluctantly dragged before the Senate and Congress. They said, oh, yeah, we'll hire more fact checkers. And, you know, I ask anyone, you know, after the tech hearings, did your experience on social media change? No, you put your hand up. No one ever put their hand up. Except one time when a guy went, well, as a coder, I can tell you that. And I didn't know what he was talking about. The point remains. So this is where I think we are with this stuff. And, you know, the takeaways are, you know, let's reconceptualize the way we deal with fake news, lying. And let's understand that the Greek space, for those of you interested in this, and that's Greece and Cyprus, is now an informational battleground and a very important one. Okay, that's me.
Thanks, David. That was great, and that's not a lie. Thanks very much indeed. An information pandemic, a salutary warning.
An infodemic, yes.
Thank you, sorry, yes. Eleni, great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, and thank you very much for the invitation. I will try to add some comments. Many things are already told by my great co-panelists, so I will try to find something novel to say. I was thinking that this pandemic has had many firsts, and one of those was that it was the first great pandemic of the digital age, and that made the very fertile ground for a great rise of health disinformation and conspiracy theories. And conspiracy theories always existed. They were usually these unusual people that you would meet once in your life, or that you knew someone who knew someone who believed something crazy. But now you found in the past 2 years during the pandemic that these people are now amongst maybe your family, maybe your friends, maybe they're your coworkers. So, and the drill usually, I'm sure most of you had the experience, is the following, that they keep saying that events are orchestrated by a team of villains who are aiming to destroy the world and become even more powerful themselves. Even when explanations are far more probable, conspiratorials will insist that it's the 5G, the cause of the pandemic, or that in the vaccine there will be a microchip by Bill Gates that will be installed in your body. And the degree that these theories are believed by people can be found even in arson attacks on cell towers around the world. I was reading this news that in many parts of the world, people are actually attacking cell towers as the cause of the pandemic. So everyone with this pandemic, everyone's susceptible to conspiracy theorizing, especially because we are all feeling anxiety We are uncertain about the future. So that's, I think, a very fertile ground for conspiratorial theories. And I think in a more, let's say, human way, as humans, I think we don't like we don't like things that are difficult to understand. So we prefer things that are easy to understand. And I think in this case, in a pandemic, when it's a very medical, medical terms are involved and you have to explain events leading from some bats that had a disease and that spread to humans and over to the world, and it's a complicated thing to explain. So a theory that Bill Gates or some other billionaires are doing all this to control us in some way that nobody really knows how, makes people think that, okay, maybe I understand what's happening in the world. And I think that's why it's not surprising that false news are the ones who spread so much faster than the truth. I was reading an experiment by this professor called Bosugi. I don't know if I prefer his name very correctly. He's at Dartmouth, and he found that the top 1% of false news are diffused between 1,000 and 100,000 people, whereas the truth rarely diffused to more than 1,000 people. So it's insane if one thinks how many people, how fast and how wide is the range of fake news. So also, if we think now that we're saying that's a pandemic that happens on an online time, then we should not forget that you have different online platforms that appeal to you. So, and you are much more targeted than before. You can have information that pop up in your social media on Facebook. Facebook is actually the largest aggregator of news in the globe. And the fact that according to algorithms, you can see posts and news that are close to your beliefs according to your likes and posts of the past and reinforce your beliefs, that makes you believe more that things that you are actually believing are actually what the whole world believes. So, but I think that maybe we should not dismiss, I mean, conspiracy theories so easily, because they represent some fears that humans have, and that the idea that that COVID, for example, was created in order to implant people with computer chips and to control them, it might be ridiculous in many different ways, but it presents a real and realistic fear for surveillance technology. And I think, at least in Greece, we felt, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, that you are giving a lot of information to the government and that you could be surveilled in some way. So I don't think, of course, that anybody planned it, but I think that it is a reality that we see a huge rise of implementation and acceptance of surveillance technology all over the world. Now in Greece, I was reading this, Nikos, I think, explained it perfectly in terms of the media setting here in the country. I was reading a study by the Media Literacy Index 2021, and Greece is one of the most vulnerable countries to Europe to misinformation fake news. It was in place 27 among 35 countries, so really low. UK is number 10, so it's doing much better. And what was interesting in that study, what was interesting to me, was that such low results were correlated to the mediocre performance of children in Greek schools and their critical ability. So in text comprehension and in other places, Greek students were scoring lower than the average. So I think a piece of information that we should keep is that critical thinking in school can actually lower the misinformation. Greater cognitive reflection, science knowledge are associated with stronger discernment in regard to COVID-19. And I think indicators for media freedom, quality of education, interpersonal trust, and e-participation can also serve as predictors to the level of resilience of a society to fake news. So the concept of media literacy, is employed to gauge the potential for resilience to the negative effects of diminishing public trust, severely polarized politics, and fragmented media, among others. So I think maybe one solution would be to have greater education in schools and hopefully stronger media that would convince convince people to read them and not think that there's always a big interest or corruption that leads to the decisions of the media owners, at least in Greece.
Thank you, Eleni. These are powerful contributions. Let me pass to John to chair the discussion.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kevin. Let me first thank you for your generous introduction at the start. It's fantastic that the League is doing something finally with the Hellenic Observatory at the LSE. Those of you who already know the League know that we were founded by the principal of the LSE and the principal of King's College London in 1913. So we are your creature, Kevin, and it's great to be here doing this event with you. Thank you to all four speakers for what I thought was a really fascinating opening round of observations, which gives us a whole series of different points to latch into. We're going to start off with a few rounds digging into between us some of the points that have been made, but please let this not dissuade you in the audience from putting up your questions. We're not going to answer any of the questions on the screen. We will pick them up when we get to an appropriate point in the conversation. We've got four questions up already, which strikes me as a small number. So please, please do keep them going. I know we can keep talking at our own initiative, as it were, for the entire period, but please let this also be your session. So please do be forthcoming with questions. As the opening contributions have shown, we are dealing with something which we kind of instinctively feel ought to be simple. Everyone, in theory, knows the difference between fact and fiction, between truth and a lie. But actually, we seem to be caught in a muddle of enormous complexity in the Western world at the moment. We have what some regard as an epistemological crisis with no consensus on the existence of things such as objective truth. We have polarization, really extreme polarization in the political game, which suggests that the world is actually retreating to, well, alternative versions of the truth. But that sounds a rather pat and optimistic way of describing what may actually be happening. We're seeing through social media an extraordinary outpour of emotionalism and emotion. These platforms are used by all sorts of people, including rather calm and rather moderate people, to express views in a often a highly intemperate way. What is causing all of this emotion to bubble out onto these new platforms? We also see this taking place at a time when authority has been increasingly questioned, and indeed the availability of alternative sources of information is part of that destabilization of authority. And among the people at large, people like me who read the social media and also the mainstream media, we see very fashionable notions of cynicism going beyond a sort of epistemological skepticism to a sort of cynicism about motive, a cynicism about the very possibility that media, whether social or mainstream, can bring us anything resembling a truth that we ought to be accepting because it has authority. So we face a whole series of challenges to our understanding and our interpretation of the world around us. I think the question I would like us to start with is the big question of who should be acting. I think all of us around this virtual table see ourselves as being on the side of truth and against fake news and against lying and against inauthenticity. But who is actually responsible for digging us out of this hole, which we seem to be getting deeper and deeper into? Who'd like to start with that big question? Whose is the responsibility? I'm sure it's not just one person's responsibility, but where should we start in terms of putting together a coalition that will enable us to be more confident about sources of truth?
I I could start if you like, John. I mean, it's the short answer to your question is everyone has to play their part. I don't think the burden should be largely on governments and regulators, to be honest, because I don't think this is a problem that can be dealt with in its entirety by laws. I mean, laws. I think it was David said, look, there are laws in place for things like hate speech and so on. It's just a question of enforcing them. You could tweak some of those laws. I mean, as I said, to cover things like anonymous disinformation and so on. Fundamentally, a lot of the necessary legal tools are there. It's just a case of adapting them a bit to the new environment. As regards the mainstream media, I mean, they're in an unusual position of, they, at the end of the day, they're commercial businesses, most of them. They've got to make money. And in the new environment, it's incredibly hard for a lot of them to make any money. And that raises the question of whether you should have initiatives such as the Jeff Bezos thing at the Washington Post, where he kind of just threw, what for him was small change. Just threw it at the Washington Post. Actually, it really helped them, and it's become a much better paper since he did that. And he hasn't really tried, as far as I can see, tried to sort of interfere with the editorial line or anything. It's improved them. So maybe there is a role for philanthropists, perhaps. And so apart from governments and the traditional news media, I mean, lastly, you've got this thing of which I think all of us touched on, which is a more alert, better educated public. I mean, and so that's a question for schools and so on. It's an arduous task, but I mean, it has to be done.
Can I come in on that? Yeah. So yeah, I want to be clear. When I talk about regulation, I do not mean on the press. Right? There is enough regulation on the press, and I certainly don't want to see any more. I'm talking about social media companies. You're right, Tony, completely. These laws exist, but they are just not going to be enforced. Look, I am, in my book, one of the people I profiled was a chap called Alberto Fernandez. Now, he was the man in charge of ISIS counter-messaging for the State Department. That's the US State Department. And he was rowing constantly with Twitter, saying, can you please take down these ISIS fanboy accounts? Like, take them down. And they would not take them down. This was the US government. This was ISIS. And in the end, it was only when poor James Foley was beheaded and there was so much outrage from Twitter users, they took them down, because they keep coming back to this point that these are not, there's an expression that the person that invented gambling was brilliant, but the person that invented chips was a genius. I kind of say the same thing. Social media, the people who invented it were brilliant, but the people who invented the language around social media, this idea of a news feed doesn't really consist of news, but the greatest word here is platform, and it's like this has very neutral connotations. We can all have a chat. It's not a platform, it's a business. The fact is, Nazis buy trainers too, and they're just not going to cannibalize their own business by throwing off loads of users. They're not going to do it, they haven't done it. They say they do it, they just don't. As I say, anyone can find, and I'm not talking about rude stuff, I'm talking about utter racism, utter incitement. Like, platforms need, the government needs to take some kind of hand on regulating the platforms, because it's just the problem is too egregious now. It's endemic, not the press. I actually think there needs to be some kind of, because these are not, platforms are not the press. They're two different things, but they're just not doing it. I wish they would, but they're not doing it. And the final analysis, why would they cannibalize their own product? Because their product is us in the end, users, because we buy stuff. That's what we do. And they're just not going to, they have to throw off so many people. And I just don't think they'll do it on their own. So yeah.
Can I ask, Eleni, and then Nikos, can I just throw in, so sources of authority, and particularly thinking in terms of the vaccination campaign, but also the whole handling of the pandemic and the way in which it was described, governments across the West took rather different approaches to this. And at least in the early stages, I was struck that putting up a scientific specialist, which is what the Greek government did, to handle really all of its communications, seemed, at least in the opening stages of the handling of the pandemic, to be surprisingly effective, in that his authority was very clear, his technical knowledge, his authority, his way of dealing with and talking to the public seemed not only to be correct, but also to encourage belief. But then it's all gone to pieces. One of my questions is around the role of government and the way in which it plays in its own expertise of the people who work for it, as opposed to the political slant. Is there a much bigger role for governments to deploy their own knowledge carefully and intelligently than has perhaps been the case? Eleni, you wanted to come in next.
I want to see something about the previous conversation. I want to see something maybe in a more positive note that, as David said, you know, these platforms, the social media are something pretty new. And users in Facebook and in other social media are in large percentage older people who have not been using the internet, and they were introduced to the internet to use Facebook to connect with their friends and family, etc. And I think they're a bit, they don't really understand that things that you see on Facebook are actually not news. I think mm-hmm. they are less knowledgeable on how this whole new world works. And I'm kind of positive that younger generations are a bit more critical in what they read, that they understand that maybe there's something behind that. And I think that the more, you know, the years pass by and people are getting more acquainted to platforms and, you know, reading something and then trying to find where this comes from, will make users much more critical about the source of the information.
Mm-hmm. Nikos, do you want to come in next?
I'd like to ask my co-panelists if they have anything to say about the money that is involved in disinformation campaigns. There must be a way to follow the money back to its source. I've seen things that I don't believe. I was driving near my village in Crete in August, and I saw in two places huge slogans using many, many kilos of paint and a lot of time to paint anti-vaccination slogans. And I thought no local is ever going to do that. So somebody went and did that, and that somebody must have had a real reason to do it and must have been paid to do it. Are we following these things at any level, on the police level?
That ties into another great problem of our age, which is kleptocracy. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's huge, right? It's another existential problem of our age, I think. Following the money is incredibly hard. A lot of it from certain states, it comes out of the state, right? The problem with disinformation is that actually it's really comparatively cheap if you're a state compared to the other options, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, one of the things we need to understand that disinformation, can we just be clear on this, is just one aspect of an influence operation. What we're talking about here are all influence operations. And corruption is an influence operation, bribery is an influence operation, blackmail is an influence operation, so is disinformation. And it is enabled by corruption, by financial corruption, which is global. The two go hand in hand, especially when you look at states like Russia. That's my two cents.
Right.
Is there any role? Is there any role for kite marks, for marks of quality, for trying to give people simple or even complicated senses of the degree of authority which a particular account is claiming? I mean, I kind of think it's common sense that if you're looking at an account from NHS England, which has got the blue tick against it on Twitter, that you know you're talking to NHS England, and this is the best possible source that you have around at least the implementation of public health policy in England. But when you get into the broader world of experts who are outside, say, government or even the universities, is there a role in platforms trying to identify in some way kite marks of quality that give people some sense that they can trust these sites as sources of information? Or are we really just groping around looking for the most plausible explanation of the world that we see it? I mean, how can the platforms themselves help us?
I mean, I don't want to keep talking. I mean, who decides though, right? Who decides? Mm. This is a massive problem. So again, when the US government was doing counter Daesh messaging, they had a problem, which is who's the last person on earth young disaffected Muslims are going to listen to? The US government. So who decides? That's the big issue. And also, I think actually, you're absolutely right, it'd be wonderful, but there are logistical issues here. Imagine every guy on Twitter pretending he's an expert and every, you know, I mean, you know, they don't have the time to do these things, unfortunately. And if they do, it will just be, well, who decides? And also, I mean, Twitter can't decide who's a medical expert. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, theoretically, yes. I just think, unfortunately, it's fraught with difficulty. But the impulse is correct, totally.
Tony, you're muted.
I wouldn't want to see Twitter or Facebook kind of taking on that kind of role, to be honest. I mean, it's the role of governments and parliaments to design laws and pass laws, and I don't think Twitter and Facebook, and their role should be to obey those laws, and part of it certainly involves them, you know, which they've begun somewhat kind of ambiguous or half-heartedly to do in the last few years to shut up people who are you know, really out of order. But essentially, they should not be the ones taking the lead in this. There should be properly designed legislation to set the framework. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, Nikos.
John, no one replied to your question about the Greek government and the handling of the... Would you like me to...
Yeah, please.
...to try? Everybody was rightly very impressed by the handling of the pandemic at the beginning. The unfortunate thing, and you asked what went wrong, is it lasted too long. So we couldn't be at our best behavior for much longer than we were. That's the one thing. It unfortunately went on for far too long. The question you ask, though, I think is very valid, is that I think a government has to do these things, and it showed that government can do it and must do it. And when it acted carefully and responsibly, which it's been doing all the time, except that things are getting much more difficult, things went really extraordinarily well, and that was it used its resources to the best of its abilities. It used the right people at the right time. It was fortunate to have the right people, and there was this combination of the public's fear, having seen what was happening in Italy at the time, that played a very great role, in combination with the fact that the lockdowns came in time for the contagion not to spread in Greece. So there was a sense that we were all on the same page on that. Then just because things kept going on, the old patterns came back in, the doubts, the questioning of authority, the questioning of government, the mistakes that government makes and are always amplified and that. But I think that the way to control both the pandemic and the narrative is very much in the hands of governments. They can't control it completely, but they can do much more than anyone else can. One thing that I think, and I'm really quite illiterate in terms of technology, one thing that I would hope that the big platforms could do was to show up things that none of us can see, which is deep fakes, for example. If there is stuff like that on Facebook or Twitter, only they can find it and flag it, I assume. Because the public can never know what it's seeing, but they should have at least that obligation. If they are putting things up there, they should at least be able to say technically what this is.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something on what you said in terms of the Greek handling? I think it was also very important at the beginning that we had daily press briefings, that you had people who were scientists, the doctors, who were saying what's happening now, what you should be doing. And that was on a daily basis. And I think that really helped, in combination of having the prime minister quite often to be on camera talking to Greeks. And by having a constant flow of information, I think it really helped in in steering the public opinion and saying what is right and what is wrong, especially in the very beginning when people did not know what they should be doing, you know, with a mask, no mask. I mean, I think maybe that's also a way of treating fake news, actually being very open about what you're doing and giving a lot of information and open information to the public.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask the question, when a line of pure fakery is going around, you know, the vaccine is going to implant a microchip of Bill Gates in your bloodstream or whatever, when some line of pure fakery is going around, is it better for government to address that head on, or should other actors like journalists in the mainstream media be taking it on? I mean, what is the best way to try to knock out of the public consciousness crazy ideas which seem just to circulate and to linger and to infect the whole issue of trust between the people and the authorities? It's a tricky one. I mean, I know from David's book that he looks at the way in which the US State Department, and he's already mentioned it, looks at tried from 2014 onwards to address disinformation campaigns. And it's tried a number of different approaches, from directly addressing it to using other actors. I kind of feel there must be a role for many voices in this, because when you're combating something which is entrenched and is circulating and is poisoning the atmosphere, surely it needs quite a systematic approach from lots of different players to establish the basis of truth again, because that basis of truth in the situation of the vaccination and the pandemic has disappeared. Has it been eroded? Not to be too alarmist.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it's about credibility of messengers. You know, again, we're going to have to accept that the British government, for example, is just not the credible messenger in the eyes of many, especially target audiences. Again, people who are most, you know, most vulnerable to being swayed by, let's say, extremist jihadist narratives or extremist fascist and neo-Nazi narratives. May not be fair, but that's the way it is. So, you know, we do need to have a multiplicity of voices, you know. Frankly, you know, you need to also think about your demographics. You know, we're a bunch of, you know, apart from Eleni here, we're a bunch of middle-aged men. You know, we're not really going to be the people that reach most people. So it's about credibility of messengers. The thing is, and what we just have to accept as well, and this is, it's very unfortunate, like, there are just some people you're never going to reach, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to talk about authority, when you have the chief scientific officer of Britain stand up, and that is Chris Whitty, I think, I don't know if it's the other chap, but somebody you're just not going to reach. You know, if you genuinely believe that Bill Gates is you know, is implanted the virus, is controlling, you're probably not going to be swayed by, you know, an NHS report. So it's about who do you reach. I think the two things, mm-hmm. First of all, how credible is the messenger? So that's who is the messenger. Second of all, who are you actually speaking to? You know, like, there are people, like, I'll tweet and, you know, there are people who argue that, there'll be people who just, like, Photoshop my face onto, like, a Nazi uniform. I'm just never going to reach people like this. Or just, like, just say that I'm constantly CIA, which is actually very, very, very big blow to national pride, because no one ever says I'm MI6. They only ever say I'm CIA. So you're just never going to reach these people. So who are we reaching? And I think really it takes something, you know, take COVID. You're going to have, okay, so, you know, the vast, well, not even a majority anymore, but, you know, most people you think can accept that vaccines, pretty good thing, right? They'll have them. Then you're going to get a hardcore of pranks who, just never, whatever you say, they're never going to change their minds unless they get COVID and get very ill. You know, you see the odd case. But in between those two, there is a broad range of people. And you meet them every day, and I meet them in Greece, you know the people in cafes and the peripteros and stuff. And, you know, they're kind of in between. It's like, well, you know, I've got, I probably should, but I'm just, it's, you know, you can sort of, I'm not a vaccine denier, but it's just very new. We don't know. And those are the people you have to target. You have to understand who the messenger is and understand who you're talking to. We have to understand this as well. So, and it's just, you know, how best do you reach them? And I think that one thing that the internet has done, the one thing social media has done, is given us data, which is very problematic in many ways, but it allows you to understand different audience segments. And what unfortunately we need to do is we need to target different audience segments with what is most likely to appeal to them. That is not best served by overarching bloated centralized bureaucracies. It just isn't. And again, this is something else that we're still grappling with, because what is government? It's an oversized, centralized, bureaucratic bureaucracy. So again, that's what I think we need to do. And again, we have a lot to do, but look, we're learning, right? Still all very new to us.
I would add, I think there's a very pertinent point. I would add just one small thing, which is, I mean, you can, to some extent, without imposing any kind of censorship or anything, you can starve the lunatics of oxygen, can't you? I mean, you shouldn't be having a TV debate on it, whether it's on a current affairs program or a news program, between two sides where one person sort of saying, you know, vaccines are the right way to go, and the other person saying, you know, they've got Bill Gates in them or something. I mean, there aren't always two sides to an argument, and that's kind of been lost a little bit in recent years in the United Kingdom, I think.
I'm so sorry, I don't want to keep you, but Tony, you're absolutely right. This is a real bugbear of mine. You know, I get we need to give, but both objectivity is not both sides. Like when I was in Ukraine, I was reporting from Ukraine, and I tell them, right, so here are the tanks, here are the thing, and then they sort of, now Russia says it's not there. So well, I'm looking at the tanks. I'm like, I'm looking at them. So can we please stop this pretense that Russia is not here? And that's not objectivity. Tony's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Affording equal time to a doctor and a nut job who doesn't believe in vaccines is not journalism. And unfortunately, you amplify these things. Look, Tony unintentionally, he said in the beginning, unintentionally amplified the story. We need to understand the dangers. How do you think Donald Trump was elected? Because he got more airtime by us, by the mainstream media, than anyone else. We gave, they said something like hundreds of minutes because we were appalled when we amplified it and amplified it and amplified it. That's something, that is something that we can do very simply. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that doesn't take a lot of work. It's just decisions by senior people in media, in government. That's a very good point what Tony makes.
I will thank you for that. I will move in a question in a moment to questions from our audience. But can I just ask you a question about your own practice in relation to social media? I think at least three of you, maybe all four of you, are active on social media. How do you conceptualize this? Are you doing something different? Is this your mainstream journalism in a different mode? Is it just a representation of your mainstream journalism? Are you engaging with the audience in a different way? I mean, if you could just give us a few insights into how you as mainstream journalists are dealing with the social media, I kind of think that some of the there must be some wisdom locked in that. Who'd like to go first?
I think it's a very immediate tool. I mean, I go to it every, when I wake up, I just check my Twitter feed. I can see immediately if there's something happening, and that's really helpful. I can see what the discussion is, which I love. You see what are the trending topics and you immediately understand. I mean, the conversation, I'm not saying that this is the most important conversation that takes place in the country, but it is a conversation that takes place in the social media sphere. I can be a bit more personal than I am in my mainstream media identity, that you can say something that's more personal. And you can also communicate with people, which is great. I mean, they can write something to you, or many times they've given me tips also. That's a good story. Maybe you can check that more. And then I have found many people, many contacts for my stories. I have found them through Twitter. So it is a staple for me. I mean, it's like a basic tool that I am using right now. Mm-hmm. And I find that, you know, the more you use it, the more input you will get. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's very positive. On the other hand, I have to say that during the Greek crisis, I was a Brussels correspondent for Kathimerini and Sky TV, and there was so much tension just between the European partners and the Greek government at that time, Syriza government. I was heavily bullied in Twitter. I had many hate messages. I had messages, many sexist messages about my looks and my appearance and how horrible I look or whatever, and by trolls. And I mean, you wouldn't have that if you weren't in Twitter, but people can really express their hatred as well. I mean, when you say news that they really don't like, and in my case, it was very partisan. It was like I was attacked. That's the dark side of using a social
media. And is that, thank you for that, Eleni, is that everybody's experience, that it's something that you dip into and use, it gives you tips?
I mean, look, yeah, Eleni's absolutely right. It's the best news feed you can get. If you want to, if you're covering a crisis, if you're covering war, following is the best thing for following things in real time, which I found as sort of a war correspondent, foreign correspondent. The trolling is awful as well, but I have to say, Eleni is a woman, and so she gets it much worse. I mean, I get trolls, but, women just have it much, much worse, especially ones that dare to disagree with people online. So I don't have it that bad. So, yeah, for me, I mean, it's fundamentally an unpleasant thing, Twitter, but you do need it. Sometimes it can be good, but I need it. Some journalists, don't need it because they're so big. I'm not.
Would any of you describe yourselves as primarily broadcasting through it? I mean, so there's use of it for you as sources of information or misinformation or whatever, but are any of you actually using it as a means of doing something different with your journalism, or is it just a way of amplifying stories by tweeting them on or whatever? Do you engage with people in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, some people are very good at that. John, I'd actually like to ask you a question. I'm very fascinated. What do you think this has done to diplomacy? Because, I remember Tumas Ilves really put Estonia on the map because he's, when he was president. But as a diplomat like yourself, this is why I'm interested. How is it changing diplomacy?
I think it's a very good question. I think there are, I would answer that in with the same sort of answer that we've heard earlier, that this has been going for 10 years or so, and I think we're still in a very experimental phase. I kind of think that there was a huge amount of enthusiasm at the start and a sort of reckoning with reality as we go along. First, it's actually very difficult as a diplomat to genuinely engage through Twitter because you are there representing a government, you are not there tweeting in your own name, you're representing a government. So what you can say, and in some cases must say, is tightly circumscribed. Yes, you should. I used this pretty extensively when I was there, but I was always extremely careful, and particularly around the marshalling of government lines. And I tended to use it more as a sort of social interaction. It is social media, a social interaction with a wider group of people across Greece than I would otherwise have met in my daily business. But I know that some of my peers in countries where I think the mainstream media weren't as intensely following what individual diplomats were doing were able to push the boat out a bit and to use it as a genuine tool. I thought, frankly, it wasn't much more use than another channel for getting out government messages. And for talking to people socially in a wider group than I would otherwise have had. But I certainly don't think it was the sort of transformative device that some of my colleagues, I think, thought it would be. And I think for them, it may have been. But in a Western, sophisticated, very intense society where everybody is watching everybody else for mistakes, you had to be careful, I think, above all else.
Makes sense.
Let me go to questions. They're piling up, and there's some good questions. Let me go first to a question from Dennis McShane, former Europe Minister. He asks, isn't part of the problem anonymity? Democracy is based on citizens taking responsibility for their speech in the public place. Newspapers in the past, for example, might have published an anonymous letter with name and address withheld, but at least the editor knew the identity of the author and could judge the validity of points made. Twitter, in particular, allows any lie, smear, hate attack, defamatory statement to be published and multiplied 1,000 or more times. If the authors of such disinformation were obliged to publish their name and take responsibility for what was published, this might slow down the level of lies and disinformation. Views on that? Less anonymity, more being clear about your identity? Who wants to go first?
I think we touched on it, didn't we? In the last hour, I think each of us probably said, you know, it can be really poisonous, and it seems to encourage the worst, doesn't it? So I think that probably is an area where you could have regulation.
This is the perennial debate. And I think we need time now, but you absolutely cannot get rid of anonymity because, you know, this is how people in Syria get stuff out, right? When I was in Ukraine, this is what, you know, how people were getting stuff out of Ukraine. You just need anonymity for people in authoritarian states to get stuff out. But I do accept that, you know, so much of this poisonous stuff, I mean, the people abusing Eleni would not have done it, you know, been so brave had they, you know, I bet most of them were anonymous or anonymous, pseudonymous rather. But we just can't get rid of anonymity because it's too important to all these people in dreadful authoritarian states to at least have some kind of a voice.
Mm-hmm. A question here from Lucia Nixon. This is about the echo chamber. We haven't spoken much about this. I mean, the echo chamber is a phenomenon that we all recognize. We may be part of echo chambers of our own choosing. Of course, the algorithms that the platforms use multiply this exponentially, lock you down in these chambers. The question from Lucy Nixon is, what are the panel's views on fake news and identity, the way that people choose a certain identity aligned with a set of affiliations, so that if someone identifies with a particular group, then they'll automatically believe people who purport to speak for that group? How can we break out of this this phenomenon? This is part and parcel of the experience of social media.
Yeah, again, sorry. It's constitutionally is what it does. I mean, and it's the thing about silos is it's not even that you're subjected to sort of. Just the voices you disagree with. It's the fact that you can construct different realities. Let me just give you an example, if I may. So during Operation Protective Edge, which was the 2014 Israeli war with Hamas, a chap called Gilad Lotan, he created a graph and he mapped where all the pro-Palestinians and all the pro-Israelis got their information from. And it was literally two clusters. There was one point of overlap, which was Haaretz. Now, 20 years ago, let's say, pro-Palestinian and pro-Israelis would have basically, how would they have consumed their information? Well, they'd have watched CNN or BBC, which fundamentally is curated by, you know, professional journalists, professionally edited. And here's the thing, they would have looked at the same footage. Now, they would have drawn their own conclusions, but they would have looked at the same, but there was a shared reality. Fast forward, one cluster, another cluster. When everything you see, everything you hear, everything you read, conforms to your point of view, you can't have a dialogue with someone else because you can't disagree. They're a liar because you've seen it, you've heard it, you've read it, you've heard it. So I think it's not so much that it gives us, well, it is that, you know, it reinforces our own point of view. It makes our opponents completely, it separates them so much that they become enemies. But here's the thing. I mean, this is what social media, you know, is constitutionally designed to do. When social media is based upon friends and followers, i.e. you choose who your friend and follow, you can't do it any other way. Now, you know, I every so often I give a talk, you know, friend and follow people you don't agree with, but I mean, you know, who does that really? It doesn't work. Again, these are constitutional issues with the tech. I just keep going on about this, like the fundamental structures of which we are on are just geared towards different things. Truth, I'm sort of make things go viral, it just doesn't. And again, if I tweet that, you know, correct information about coronavirus, it gets 5 tweets, and someone tweets lies, it gets 100 tweets, it's a more successful tweet. It just is. Doesn't matter that mine's morally better. That's not the metrics on which these platforms are based.
Yeah.
I think what David just said is very important, the fact that we're living now in different realities, that in the past you had a common ground that, for example, coronavirus exists. People would agree in a basic truth. Now with social media, that you have such different inputs and such different information, you end up having completely different realities and and extreme polarization, which I don't think existed in the past. The polarization is amplified by these platforms because your beliefs are retweeted and you just see people having the same belief. So you really get to know, you get one side of the story, and that's mm-hmm. so dangerous about it.
Mm-hmm. Does leadership play a role? Can leadership break these silos? You talk about the Palestinian and Israeli issue, for example. If people are fanatical on one side and fanatical on the other, does anything change that?
I mean, it's the age-old question, but not when their fanaticism is being reinforced by everything they consume, I would suggest, with no filter for anything else. I mean, look, seeing the same thing, you know, doesn't make you agree, as Eleni pointed out, but at least there's some basis for conversation. There's just no basis now. So it increases polarization. You know, one of the byproducts of the internet is an increase in extremism of all forms. And also, look, we have to understand that in England, you know, he used to say that nutters, he wrote, you know, would write into the newspaper in green ink, you know, this is, you know, mad people. Now, the thing is, like, I see a lot of people say, like, oh, you know, all these mad people, they were always there, but you could ignore them. The problem is, now, you're an anti-vaxxer, you believe that the queen is a lizard. You go online, there's 10,000 other of you. You're not a nutter anymore, you're a movement. And there's something else I want to say finally. It's like, we need to understand, like, the mob. Now, Cicero knew what the mob was like. Shakespeare knew what the mob was like. Twitter is the mob empowered. When those, you know, those trolls, you know, latched on to Eleni, it was the mob. The problem is, like, back in the day, they may have sent a letter to Catherine O'Neill or something she could do. Now they're jumping all over her feet. Everything she says, they're pouncing. Now, this will never change until we can disengage the mob. And if the mob, you can see it. You see the way Twitter works. You see the ways that it demands sacrifice over them. You can see the cadences of the mob. It's not all, not everyone. But this is something else we really need to sort of talk about, which is, you know, it is the mob. And these, as well as creating division, as well as, you know, being sort of geared towards virality, they empower the mob.
Mm-hmm. Tony, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, on this point of silos being created by the social media and so on, I'd be a little cautious about assuming this is something new. I mean, societies... In the modern era, by which I mean with industrialization, you find actually a similar kind of thing. I'm thinking of, for example, Germany before the First World War. You'd find that there are the Prussian militaristic aristocrats. There's a bourgeois middle class. There's a social democratic voting industrial working class. There are the liberals and the Catholics, and they really were in their own silos, and they had their own kind of places of social gathering, their own newspapers, their own gymnastics organization, everything, and they didn't talk to each other. It was a highly stratified silo type society, actually. And I would also, you know, if you were to look at, for example, Britain after the Second World War, you'd see, you know, roughly 50% of the people vote Conservative, 50% vote Labour. I mean, you could pretty much see that going all the way on to the 70s. But the crucial thing there was you had a kind of common information sphere in the sense that, you know, people, as television began, people got their news from the BBC. And that was a national experience. Everyone gathered around the TV in the evening and watched the same thing. And that's what's gone, of course. But I don't think silos as such are actually as new as we might think.
Mm-hmm. One of our audience, Catherine Roy, picking this up, says that in the US, the media frequently refuse to write about or broadcast a story that doesn't fit their narrative. Sometimes the lead story on, say, Fox isn't covered by ABC, NBC, CNN, etc., and vice versa. It's other times the same story is covered in a radically different way, depending on who's covering it. The differences are so radical, it scarcely seems the same story is being considered. If one has only limited time to read about current events, how can one get at the truth or the closest approximation thereof when all sides from left to right seem to be biased? So there are quite a few questions all on this theme about the sheer plurality of information misinformation, some disinformation, but just the sheer plurality of sources of information coming to people. What would your tips be, practical tips be for your readers? I mean, how to sort this out? Because we do need to sort it out. We do need to get straight in our own minds answers to questions on shall I be vaccinated? Tips.
I think one important thing is when you get an article on Facebook is to check where this article comes from. I mean, you might see a title of, I don't know, something Times, and you feel like this is some important newspaper, but you have to Google it and see if that looks reliable, if it does have journalists, if, you know, just dig a little bit more, like 2-3 searches. I'm not asking for many things. If something sounds absurd, right? I mean, you have to double check it. Don't just retweet it or repost it immediately. Just take a deep breath, do 2 searches on Google and see what you find.
That seems good advice to me. Any other points to make?
Yeah, please, people, please take a look at your governments and understand just how utterly incompetent they are. They can't even collect the bins properly. The idea they could all get together with Bill Gates or do 9/11 is just simply implausible. Please think about it. That's my advice.
There's a quite a tough question here. I don't know if we will be able to deal with this one, but I think it's a good question. From Chrisa Kapi, she says, I'm concerned by the fact that quite a significant part of false information regarding the pandemic is distributed by supposedly scientific sources. Is it possible that information technology has allowed pseudoscience to widen its audience? Shouldn't scientific bodies try to control the quality of information that's disseminated via open source and self-publishing media? So there's a kind of number of things wrapped up in there. One, the question of control, but let's take it as not a question of control, but as a wider question. What is the role of expert bodies in combating misinformation? Again, this comes back to a question I posed earlier. Should sources of authority, knowing themselves to be in authority's positions, be combative and assertive, or should they essentially pass over the more crazy ideas that are transmitted across society?
You have to. You can't kick at every dog that barks. And you have to. Again, just be careful that don't amplify stuff, right? If something is worth combating, then do it. But for God's sake, just don't amplify every nutter. Because you understand it, if you do, there will be a constituency of people that will ignore what you're saying and read the original disinformation.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that we should, may I speak, John?
Yes, please do.
One thing we should be aware of is we do have a very serious problem with disinformation, but we must also realize that the vast majority of people, media, groups, everybody involved in society is very much on the same page. I mean, we have the problem that we have, but here in Greece, where we have it quite prominently, a recent poll showed that 7% of those polled were completely against having the vaccination. That is not a huge number. So there are a lot of other people who would be wavering, who would be careless, who would be not just on another in another dimension for a bit, but not totally lost. So the effort can be made at every level. This thing that Tony said at the beginning of the discussion, everybody has to be involved in this, and the journalists who can should be, the professional bodies who can should be. Everybody has to be in on this, because the problem it becomes very big because we're uncoordinated and a little bit panic stricken about its very existence.
Tony,
you know, these things go in historical cycles, and one day the tide will turn in favor of reason and enlightenment again, once we've seen how the people who aren't reasonable enlightened, how they screw everything up. So the tide will turn, but we're not there yet for sure.
I think that's a good point on which to invite, I think, Nikos, Eleni and David to comment if they'd like. I was going to ask you a closing question. What's your prognosis for the future? This is a cluster of new technologies that we're all dealing with. My personal experience is that I am now dealing with social media in a completely different way from 5 years ago. I'm more selective, I'm more choosy. I try to look at authoritative sources across a broad range of, say, political views, but I don't let myself be pounded by 5,000 followers. I once let every flower bloom in my Twitter feed, but that way I think is overload way. What's our view? Are we, as Tony says, going to reacquaint ourselves with enlightenment values? Is the prognosis good? Will we get the hang of this in a way which is good for society? Eleni?
I think so. I think I agree with your analysis and the way you use your social media and what I said before, like people, it's a new thing what we are having. These social media platforms are relatively new. People are new to it. And I think the more you spend time working with them, you understand better how they work. And I think as time goes by, people will be more suspicious of the information they get. I hope. I mean, I see them with myself also, that who are these followers who are tweeting and grabbing my attention. So I hope that this will be a trend of the coming years, that people are going to be more cautious of what they read and what they believe. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Nikos, David?
I tend to be optimistic in that there is a kind of a critical mass of people with good sense, and that have the necessity to cater to them will make the technology platforms more responsive to this in the long run, I think. I worry more about the total control that is given to very few organizations over everything that we do and say and share in the meantime, but we'll see where that goes. But I think the more important thing is, coming back to very, very old school stuff, is how people behave, whether they're on Twitter or not. I mean, if you have someone like Donald Trump, he is the issue, not the platform. So there's that to deal with, and then we can deal with the other things too.
Thanks, Nikos. David?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would agree with Nikos, except I would say that the platforms encourage and enable that type of politician. That's my point. Look, I mean, the thing about all this stuff is a lot of it is technology driven, right? You never get, you know, and you always can catch up with the technology. But, you know, I'm British and I just think it'll be all right in the end. I think it'll get worse probably for a bit before it gets better. But look, everyone's always catastrophizing about everything. Generational narcissism, I think, it's a serious problem, right? I think it magnifies things. You know, as Tony says, like, these things were always there. There's nothing new here. It's about the degree, right? The degree of it. And the degree of it's bad, but I think there is a critical mass of people. Look, people don't want to be lied to, right? People don't want to live a life surrounded by disinformation. People don't want these things. So I'm hopeful that in the end, it will come through. But it's going to be rough for a little bit.
Very good. Well, thank you all for, I think, I hope the audience will agree with me. It's been a very thoughtful and constructive set of propositions and points of discussion. I mean, this is something which is going to occupy us for years to come. I think one thing which is abundantly clear is that this degree of information complexity that we're all dealing with is not going to go away. And indeed, despite the disadvantages, the advantages are many too. And one can see that the availability of information through Web 2 has revolutionized all of our lives in good ways, as well as in these less positive ways that we need as a society to keep talking through and finding a way through. So thank you for fantastic contributions. Thank you to all of the audience for your questions. We didn't answer every question literally, though I think we dealt with all of the issues raised in the open questions as we've gone around. So I hope you won't feel that you've been ignored. I certainly have read all of the questions. I think we've got through them all one way or the other. And now let me hand back to Kevin.
Let me add my thanks as well. I thought for a moment that we were going to finish on a pessimistic note, but I appreciated very much the optimistic comments at the end. I also thought that we were going to finish with a sense of, was the French Revolution a good idea? It's too early to tell, whether the social media would have to wait for that length of time for evaluation. Can I thank everyone? And let me mention that the next event for the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE will be on the 25th of November. And we're delighted that we'll be hosting Alexis Papahellas, the editor-in-chief of Cathay Marini, to talk about his new book, Greece and Cyprus in a Dark Room, 1967 to 74. UK time, that's the 25th of November at 16:00. We look forward to that conversation, which you can see on your screens now. Upcoming events, look at LSE Hellenic Observatory, and also, of course, look at Anglo-Hellenic League for the website for its activities as well. Let me thank John in particular for chairing the discussion, and thank you all for joining. Thank you and good night wherever you are.
Thank you.